Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Public Health Matters, part of the Pharmacy Focus podcast series here with Pharmacy Times. My name is Dr. Christina Madison, and I am your host for today. I am so excited to bring another extraordinary guest to you all today, Dr. Jose Cocolon Calderon, who is a colleague of mine that I have had the amazing opportunity to collaborate with and work with in the past through our efforts to get out information that is factual and accurate during the pandemic. We also follow each other pretty closely on LinkedIn and social media, and I'm always excited to see what new adventures he's getting into in the space of health advocacy, vaccine advocacy, and just being an overall wonderful pediatrician and incredible human. So with that being said, I'm gonna go ahead and let Dr. Cocolon Calderon introduce himself, and then we're gonna dive into some questions.
Thank you very much, Dr. Madison, for the very, very nice and kind introduction. As well, I definitely follow your work and your adventures as well. So thank you. I'm really excited and an honor to be here today. I am Jose Cucalón Calderón. I'm a general pediatrician by training and an associate professor of pediatrics for the University of Nevada, Reno School of Medicine. I am board certified. I work in Reno, Nevada as a general pediatrician within our community at our Medicaid pediatric clinic through the renowned Children's Hospital Web of Services. I'm a native from Ecuador. I'm a native Spanish speaker. And being one of the few native Spanish speaking pediatricians, I serve a large Latino / Spanish speaking community here in Northern Nevada. Given my experience and my background, I also serve in multiple capacities, both local at the state level, national level, and international, talking about preventive health services, about helping families make a best evidence-based choices that are going to be beneficial for themselves and their kids. With the common things being tobacco prevention, tobacco cessation, vaccination, being able to access healthcare services, being able to understand health information and utilize it to make those beneficial choices. Thank you very much for having me here today.
Of course, it's my pleasure. So, you know, with that being said, I want to kind of unpack a little bit of what you said there. I think that's pretty incredible, the fact that you are one of, I think, the only native Spanish-speaking pediatricians in Northern Nevada, which is pretty incredible when you think about how many individuals that really encompasses. I don't know how large your practice is, but that seems pretty daunting, especially when I think about how important health literacy and language are really intertwined. And having someone who's a native Spanish speaker, I think makes so much of a difference when you are trying to communicate those preventative care needs and really help, you know, people navigate through the healthcare system, especially if they're new to this country.
Yes. So my practice currently, I don't know the exact number, but I can say easily is over 60% in Spanish. And most parents are born abroad. Their children most of them are born here in the United States. And definitely there are both differences in how people utilize healthcare services, what they feel that is important, and how people also think about it. I always say one of the things that I can tell you is that where I come from, generally preventive health services is something that you can find in the bigger cities and maybe in some government campaigns about that send kind of like care groups or health fairs to different towns where people get vaccinated. Maybe they get a diabetes test and stuff like
health
that.
workers, some of those like fairs and stuff. Yeah.
And that is how a lot of people are used, or that's what healthcare looks for them. So they end up showing up only to the doctor when they have a real problem, like needing to get a leg amputated.
Yeah, that's the biggest issue I think we see in general is the, you know, this, you know, going to propagating healthcare facilities only for acute care needs and not for maintenance and health and wellness, right? And so I always tease and say I'm, you know, an unlikely pharmacist that doesn't like medication and prefers for people to prevent illnesses versus doing chronic disease management, because really once you have it, it's so much harder to manage versus it is to prevent. So one thing I did want to just touch on before we get too far, you know, into, you know, a lot of the specific work that you do. And I love the fact that you're very forward facing and in the media, because again, I think representation matters, is like, how did you decide, you know, with your professional journey, because obviously being a pediatrician, being an academician, both of those things we have in common, you know, how do you go from, you know, doing your day to day and being, you know, just a great pediatrician to really seeing, you know, this desire to do vaccine equity and advocacy work? Because that is really a shift and is very purposeful. So if you could maybe talk about like how that came to be and what really kind of precipitated your journey professionally towards this, I think that that would be really helpful for the audience, especially for those who maybe are considering doing more advocacy work in their own communities.
So HPV vaccination, that probably...
That was what did it, huh?
Yeah, that is probably what ended up putting me on that path to be able to talk about not only the cancer prevention part piece of HPV, but trying to break down the stigma that was around this vaccine, because more common than not, when working with Latino communities, I was always getting the STD piece first, and that was always the big concern. And that definitely played a part into that. Then families being able to actually talk about their concerns and be able to make that choice with the information that they were able to utilize, not only in the way that they are able to read and understand and use the information, but also in a way where they are able to also access the service, not only the information, because a lot of times we don't have a good resource available in our community that will be able to provide that service at that specific time. So what happens, or how do we end up being able to also mirror how people utilize healthcare to begin with and go where they are and go and talk to them in the way that they can understand it, and then they, in a way that they can access that service? So kind of like that interplay ended up doing it. COVID-19 had a large part. COVID-19 and influenza vaccination also had a recurrent role in this. When the COVID-19 pandemic happened, and we were talking about vaccinations, there were very few people across the state of Nevada who actually could speak in Spanish about evidence-based.
You were so hugely impactful. I mean, as somebody who was on a lot of those panels and things with you, and just seeing, you know, you out front and being really that beacon for the Latinx community, it was really lovely to see, and unfortunate kind of in the same vein, because I had no idea how few people we actually had that could speak authoritatively and in language and appropriately to such a large portion of our population here in the state of Nevada.
Absolutely. And so in the state, we have roughly 30% of the population identifies as Latino or Hispanic. And a large proportion of that population is Spanish speaking. That might be what they identify as their primary language, even if they are speaking English now more and more as they live here. And then on the other side of things is that we, through the state, now, according to AAMC data, are doing a little better, where we are at the national average for physicians who identify as Hispanic and Latino, at the national average, which is 6%.
I was just going to say, what's the average? That doesn't 6%. Sound like a very good benchmark.
So that is a very big gap in between that. That we are definitely trying to fill, and we are definitely trying to encourage show that there are people doing the work. So people who come from similar backgrounds who want to serve the same community can end up realizing, okay, that person is doing it. The background is similar. Maybe I can see that person. I can see myself in that role. Maybe I can see that person being my mentor. Maybe I trust him because he speaks Spanish. He or she speaks Spanish. So playing along with all of those things are things that we're trying to actually get off the ground through the School of Medicine. And then we also are trying to do some culturally humble training, recognizing that teaching our students and our residents that the patient is going to be the authority on why they do what they do, how they do it with what they have available. So recognizing that, and then recognizing the part of language through our medical Spanish our Spanish for medical encounters elective, are some of the things that we have running right now through UNR School of Medicine, as well as including in some of the programs through the pediatric residency. But the idea there overall is for see it to be it. It's for people to identify themselves with a mentor, with somebody who is doing a career path, who is trying to make a difference, and for them to see themselves being able to do the same in a similar manner.
I love that so much. Medically humble, right? Like, oh, it's so interesting how language has such an impact. Absolutely. Right? Medically humble and being able to see yourself, right? So also as someone who is a minority and didn't see anybody who looked like me on, you know, in places that I thought maybe that I might want to go, or even just underrepresentation within the media around medical health expertise. So that I also think is a big thing as well, because I know you do a fair amount of media and you do quite a bit of medical expert commentary for your local media market too, is, you know, that representation is so important, and seeing somebody that looks like you, that sounds like you, it turns on a different switch in your mind that is not the same as somebody who may have the most authority in the world, but doesn't have the perspective of your lived experience, or even that you can be medically humble towards them.
Totally right.
Which I love that. I love that so much.
So I have told this anecdote before, but I trained in Alabama, where there is a very low Latino population, and I lived in Alabama for close to 7 years.
Wow.
At one point in time, I was realizing that nothing that I was doing was actually working out, or not working in the way that I thought it would, when trying to provide anticipatory guidance, trying to connect people with services, trying to talk about healthcare needs, trying to all the stuff that we normally do in an encounter. And then I just decided to start asking people, like, so what do you do for this? And I started doing that. And it definitely allowed for me to be able to I was practicing cultural humility without knowing it, because I learned about what cultural humility was when I came here to Reno, thanks to Dr. Nicole Jacobs. But I had already been practicing it for over 4 years as a kind of like a survival skill, like a based on observations that I had had with my patients. Just started asking them like, so what, how did this happen? Where do you guys go? How do you normally think about this? How do you normally choose? And I started adjusting my plans a little bit more based on that, rather than on just coming in and giving a recommendation and then moving on to the next person. So absolutely recognizing that people are the authority of why they do anything is extremely important, especially in healthcare, because that can be the key to being able to successfully establish a relationship with a patient or a parent when we're talking about kids, to be able to continue utilizing healthcare services that are going to that, especially for preventive health, vaccination, take their medication daily when they are prescribed something that needs to be daily, and coming to the appointments and things like that.
Yeah, I think that it's so critical to have that perspective. You know, as we all navigate through this dysfunctional healthcare system, because it's dysfunctional. And, you know, as much as we want to make a meaningful change, it's hard. It's hard when you don't have the tools that you really need to succeed. And I'm glad that you're at least, you know, you're able to kind of incorporate some of these things that you've learned and then impart those through medical education to your students, and then provide them with a space to practice those skills so that when they leave, that they can hopefully take those skills with them to whatever community that they choose to live and work in later on, which is good to know. So I'm curious, what do you think is like one of the most important issues that needs to be addressed in public and population health? I know that's kind of a lofty, big question, but I'm curious because, I mean, I know obviously like you got started through your work with HPV, which is incredible to me because I think that that is such a challenging topic, and really a PR nightmare, unfortunately, because of the way that the you know, the vaccination was initially marketed. And it goes to show you how important it is to have good messaging when you bring something to market. I think if we had looked at it more like hepatitis B and called it an anti-cancer vaccine versus associated it with sex, I think we would have been much more successful. Like, you know, places like Australia, which are on track to completely eliminate HPV-related cancers in their country by the end of this, you know, decade. So, and that was through mandatory HPV vaccination.
So the biggest barrier that I, so the most important issue is going to be what a trusted message and messenger is on public health. Okay. As we were chatting a little bit offline, right now we have somebody that people trust who is going to run, who is running for office, or somebody who is an elected official talking about against vaccinating people.
Yes. We have quite a few of those actually right now.
That's exactly right. So identifying who those trusted messengers are, and then being able to recognize that mis and disinformation can come from really any place, offering physicians, offering public health specialists, offering pharmacists, people who have scientific training to be able to help manage and answer those questions and be upfront about communication, and then allowing for them to become the trusted messengers within their communities or the communities that they serve, I feel is probably going to be the way forward. The legal implications of why people do disinformation, misinformation, if they make money or not, if they do this or they do that, I'll leave that to the legislators and the legal system and all that stuff. But But I can tell you what we can do. And I feel that being upfront and recognizing those, pointing out those situations, talking about the scientific data, and being able to communicate that effectively to our communities is probably going to be the biggest the biggest win I feel we can have. So let's look at tobacco. We talk about tobacco. And by now, everybody knows that tobacco is not good for you. Like there is no, I don't feel, I have never met anybody that still thinks that tobacco is going to have health benefits. I just, up to now, I have never met anybody who does that.
Yeah, yet people continue to smoke. And now we have this new version, new fancy version called vaping. Ooh, right? Like, what is this? Like, it's so crazy to me. And people do it in public places. Like, you have to specifically tell people not to vape because they think, oh, it's smokeless. So I can just, you know, do whatever. And it's just bananas. But I love that you are doing so much within the, you know, with the tobacco cessation space. I know you work pretty closely with the Hispanic Medical Association, and I know that you've done quite a bit of like different webinars and talks and things about it. But no, it's huge. We still have a lot of issues like with people smoking. Even with smoke-free casinos, you still see people smoking.
Well, and that's going to be part of the thing here. And that's where I was going. We were able to get that health information out when the data started mounting. I don't know what was, we just had a landmark year for when this first Surgeon General report came out. I don't remember what the exact date was. Like, I think it was like 50 or 65 years. I don't remember. But without a trusted messenger who talked about the data, being able to start that process where now a much smaller percentage of the population continues to use the tobacco products, that would not happen without a trusted messenger. So that's what like people who are public health officials, people who are primary care providers, people who are physicians, people who are working in healthcare overall, that's what we should aspire to be able to do. Even if we do it on a one-to-one person, on like in a one-to-one encounter, or if we're doing it on a large platform.
Yeah, I think it's so important to remember that sometimes it's not just what's being said, but it's who's saying it that makes a difference of whether or not you move the needle, right? And whether or not someone actually, you know, feels like that call to action is something that is worth taking that next step, you know?
Absolutely.
And a lot of times it's just a matter of understanding someone's lived experience or empathizing or even just looking at things through a trauma-informed lens. So many times I've, you know, spoken to people and they've had such negative experiences with the healthcare system in the past that even just them coming to you and being there for that appointment is anxiety and trauma inducing. And that, like, it doesn't matter how well you think that you're portraying the information, it's just the act of them being there that's causing them distress. And it's like, how do you get beyond that? How do you help someone kind of rethink and change their mindset around the difference between only accessing the healthcare system when they have an acute need versus trusting, right? Because it's that trust factor. Because there's plenty of, you know, people who go to a doctor that they know, but just knowing somebody doesn't automatically instill trust. And so when you have that trust, then you can really start, you know, making a difference. And I think that for you in particular, the great thing about having this language connection is it's like another step forward towards establishing trust because you've already established that cultural connection. And sometimes that's much harder to do when you have two people speaking English, but maybe English is not their primary language.
Well, we also have to recognize that talking as a Latino who has a very specific, comes from a very small country, very specific background, very specific population, Latinos are highly heterogeneous. And
very much so, yeah.
And being able to recognize that, it a lot of times allows for the conversation to go, to continue, until you're able to find what is important to them, how your interests align, and you're able to formulate a plan together. And again, that's where the cultural humility piece comes in. There is a lot of difference between what healthcare understanding is depending on where in a country you come from. So you're from a city, you may have seen some preventive health services if you were from a lower socioeconomic status community or a more rural community.
Yeah, I was just going to say rural hair areas, a lot of times there's none of that. It's just you only go to the doctor when something's really wrong.
Absolutely. And that's going to be the part where you kind of have to identify. I have families that are from Central America and Spanish is not their native language. And I am the one.
A lot of indigenous languages, yes, and dialects that we have yet to properly, you know, make sure that we have accommodations for.
And we don't. And that's going
we
to be
do
the
not.
We
yeah.
do not. There, I spoke to the UN, what's the name of that office? To the person who manages the UNR languages line.
Oh, the language line, yeah, the teleinterpreter. Mm-hmm.
And because I had a family from Central America who barely had any Spanish, they were listed as Spanish speakers both in the hospital and when they came to see me, and they had a child who had complex health needs at the time. So I sat down, I went into a room, I realized that they, after three just exchanges, I realized that their Spanish was very limited. And I was like, okay, well, I asked them what language. They told me the language, and that language we don't have any referral, any services for, because it's extremely local and extremely, and the community is very small. So I talked to them about it, and they told me, yeah, we can have somebody on a phone who speaks this language, but you have to let us know like 2 weeks ahead of time to be able to get that person, because they have.
That's crazy.
So it might help for a preventive health service appointment, mm-hmm, if we ended up having one, but that's really tough. That's a really tough, really, really difficult thing to do.
Yeah, I saw that firsthand when I was at the health department, and I worked really closely with our tuberculosis department, and we did, you know, refugee and immigration processing. And I would have people from these very, very small rural areas within the Philippines, mm-hmm, or, you know, we had several, you know, refugees from Bhutan, and just all of these areas where, like, or even like different places in Ethiopia. So Amharic and Tigrinya, and like, there's just so many different languages.
Yes.
And just, you know, I feel like I became a citizen of the world when I had that job. I was there for 10 years, and just the cultural humility, like you said, it makes such a difference. Even when you may not speak the language fluently, but if you even just attempt, or just to introduce yourself, or to you know, be respectful of your elders, and to, you know, give someone a salutation, or to say thank you, like, it makes such a difference with the encounter. And yeah, I think we can all do better when it comes to having in language services, and that's part of public health, right? Is that communication piece, and it's often forgotten, because we tend to lean on the fact that a majority of the population is English or Spanish speaking, which isn't always the case.
Absolutely. And our goal is for people to be able to utilize those services. And
yeah, that's the bottom line. You just want people to be able to have access.
Yeah, and be able to make beneficial choices for their health and for their family. So if you are unable to get the information across to them, then that's not going to happen. On the other side of things is that it is even more important, even more so in healthcare, where we know that talking about health literacy, what people are able to understand when they are in distress actually drops. So, so if you on top of that have a language barrier, if you on top of that don't have access to health, who can do a follow-up or who can provide culturally sensitive care as a discharge, as a post-discharge plan, or there are multiple different wrinkles there, or you have an institution who doesn't have a health literacy plan for their institution. So there are a lot of different ways where that how that can play out, but being able to get that information to the family, to the person, for that beneficial health choice to happen is really important. And then if not established with primary care, being able to continue having that relationship and fostering those appointments definitely will be the way to go.
Yeah, no, there's so many like nuggets of gold that you've been able to like portray in our conversation today. I'm just curious, what are some of the ways that you suggest that other healthcare providers, such as pharmacists, collaborate with with providers such as yourself, to improve, the health and wellness of their community? Is there, any secret sauce that you think that we can take away, that's kind of the magic behind, how you've been able to really foster this like community good in the Reno area, and how you've been able to really elevate, talking about advocacy and vaccines and just preventative care and the need for more preventative care awareness?
Well, picking up the phone and making a phone.
Yeah, picking up the phone and making a phone call. Okay, well, I like that.
Being able
That's what I did. I emailed you and I was like, oh, I don't know if he's going to have time.
Being able to talk to people who are working with the same community. If you're seeing something again and again and again and again, it's probably something within the system or the way that something, like the way that the care is delivered within that community, that might need to change. And normally system change needs to be, systems need to be assessed from multiple viewpoints, okay? And having a like recognizing who your stakeholders are, who can help you form a holistic view of what might be happening, is really important. I can tell you, when I came here 6.5 years ago, I had a large portion of my Spanish speaking families who we were placing a referral for, I don't know, speech therapy or something, and they were never hearing back from anybody. And
what's happening?
So guess what I did? I ended up looking at the phone. I ended up calling the family, or they were in the office and they told me, oh yeah, we have been like expecting 3 months a phone call or something happening, and nothing. All right. So I ended up picking up the phone, the place that I referred. Either me or my office called and said, like, hey, this patient that I referred, I have the referral approved. What's going on? Oh, we were unable to get somebody who spoke Spanish to leave a message.
Oh my goodness.
And
that was it just the I mean, fact that they wow
something as simple as that, or being able to talk to my patients. They were having a really hard time making appointments with us, and what ended up happening was that the phone line that we had didn't have a Spanish option.
Talk about like something that is like such a monumental problem that could be fixed so easily.
Or we have another issue that I have brought up before, is when we, so we have a mental health is something that carries a lot of stigma within the Latino community. So being able to get mental health management, it is really difficult, because having non-medication based mental health services that are in Spanish is tough in town. We have a lot, we normally have a long wait time for most of those services. But then for the medication management, especially for patients who are on Medicaid, it also is extremely challenging. So I was starting a medication, I was seeing the patient back in what I don't know, a month, and they would tell me that the medication got denied. I wouldn't get a letter from the pharmacy, I wouldn't end up getting a phone call from the pharmacist or from the family because they just had no idea what they had to do. So I ended up bringing this up to the to our Washoe County based Child Mental Health Consortium and then to the state. And apparently in PIT psychiatry offices, the two PIT psychiatrists that we had within the group who were invited also to comment on this, they told us that especially for patients who are on any of the Medicaid panel, on any of the Medicaid MCOs, they were prescribing 15 medications and they were getting 15 denials. And a lot of times they wouldn't even hear about the denials until the patient showed up again. So and again, Medicaid management is really complex. Choices made out of the budget that we have available is really hard. But if you have a moving target that changes every time, and then you have four different ways of doing things, and that changes twice a year, how are you going to find something that you can
continue? I'm not going to be able to do anything. Oh my goodness.
And then on top of that, if you're having a specific amount of time that a physician is able to see a patient in, and you're having to devote that time to doing paperwork, prior authorizations, calling back, calling to the pharmacy, seeing what ends up getting approved, what doesn't get approved, how fast it's going to change, that is extremely time consuming. So we were able to support a letter that we ended up sending to the office of the, to the, I think that was the office of Medicaid at the state level, and coalition building, finding how large this problem was, being able to find other stakeholders who were seeing the same thing from different viewpoints, and then offering a recommendation and a call to action was what we ended up doing. So advocacy begins with identifying a problem and then looking at the scope and then being able to see what you can do about it to change it or to improve it. I don't like the word change. Sometimes you have to just improve things. But that's going to be the way. That wouldn't happen without being able to talk to people who are also delivering care to these families and then also asking the families, because they will tell you how things look on their side. And they really, and you have a relationship where we are trying to do the right thing for our kids. And most people want the best for their kids, and not being able to carry out a care plan when they have already agreed to it, that generally is not what they want. So being able to talk about that and being able to connect with people, chat, make a phone call, ask what happened, look back at how that ended up playing out on both sides, and then offering a recommendation or maybe a solution, it would be the biggest recommendation I think I can tell. I am really happy that this year Immunize Nevada ended up awarding the most vaccine award, the most vaccines given award to pharmacies this year. Like it was, here in Northern Nevada, that was fantastic. And I am so happy to see that, because definitely that means that we are, that pharmacies are an extremely trusted resource to be able to go ahead and get people vaccinated, and making the choice to get vaccinated, it can be difficult if you don't understand why you're doing it. So, and that's going to be the space that we have in between talking, being able to direct people to the right resource, being able to start as a trusted provider, and then finding people that are serving the same community would be my specific recommendation.
Wonderful. This has been such a great conversation. I could probably chat with you for at least another hour, but I know that your time is valuable, and I want to make sure that we kind of end this episode with a little bit of a question that I tend to ask people, and sometimes they're appreciative of it, and sometimes they're not, because they're like, oh goodness, lots of things that I could say. But I always ask my guests, if there was one thing that you could tell your younger self, what would it be and why, now that you have all of this infinite knowledge?
Well, to be honest, sometimes your best is just good enough. That's probably going to be the one of the big ones. The other one would be, if something doesn't feel right, it's probably not.
Yeah, no, trust your gut, trust your feelings. Yeah.
That be a little bit be a little bit more trusting of how you feel about something specific, a specific situation, something that happened. Probably those two would be the bigger ones. You asked me for one, but I think both are complementary.
Yeah, I would agree. So if people would like to find you on social media or see and follow your advocacy work, where would they be able to do that? What would be the best for them to?
My LinkedIn would be the best resource. It's my name, Jose Cucalón Calderón. LinkedIn is open resource. If you do a search on Google with my name, that's what shows up, either that or some articles. Also, some of my work also gets highlighted regularly through the Nevada chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics, as well as the National Hispanic Medical Association webpage. But if you want to look at exactly what adventures I'm involved in at the time, like Dr. Madison mentioned earlier, it would be my LinkedIn for sure. Jose Cucalón Calderón.
Wonderful. Well, I hope that everyone listening and watching got as much out of this conversation as I did. And I'm just so grateful that we have such a wonderful advocate in our state. And I'm glad that you moved from Alabama all the way here to Nevada. It's kind of funny. So Renown Hospital used to be Washoe County Health Department or Washoe County Health Hospital. And I was actually born there. It's interesting. Every time I hear anything about Renown, I'm like, oh, that's where I was born. And so definitely have ties to Northern Nevada. But in general, just, you know, thinking about ways we can, you know, make an impact. And it doesn't have to be this, you know, grand, hairy, audacious thing. It can be just as simple as, you know, having that, you know, poignant conversation with the family and allowing for them to talk about, you know, what their concerns are and having them leave feeling, you know, fully informed and wanting to, you know, care about what next steps they need to take for their health and wellness. And I think if we just start there and we start from a service lens, you can't really go wrong. And going back to your comment, you know, your best is good enough, and that's okay. I love that.
And we are happy to partner with everybody. Primary care providers and physicians, we are really happy to partner up with families, with our patients, with other public health trained workers, because we definitely are here to be able to support your health needs, and we definitely are always looking at being able to do things better, as well as, of course, in an evidence-based scientific information way.
Of course. Well, thank you so much. Again, my name is Dr. Christina Madison. I am your host. And remember, public health matters.